You are listening to the Down the Wormhole podcast, exploring the strange and fascinating relationship between science and religion. This week, our hosts are
Rachel Jackson. My favorite science experiment when I was a kid was the classic Coke and Mentos. Or scratch that, Diet Coke and Mentos.
Ian Benz, and I wish I had made an interactive volcano.
Kendra Holt-Moore, and I once tested which brand of toothpick is the strongest.
Zach Jackson, and I once did a science fair project on the planet Uranus because no one else wanted to do it, and I felt like it needed some representation.
Boy, I mean, those are fun conversations. Okay, so last week we delved into what is religion. I very much enjoyed those conversations, and so to continue our discussion or our general introduction and foundation, setting the foundation for our podcast, we decided this week we wanted to focus on what is science. So that's the first question I want to shout out to everybody here. Is I think each of us could define, without using any definitions that we found, what is it we think about when we think about science?
Well, as a scientist, before I became a rabbi, science to me was a way of looking at the world and having the ability to, whatever we were looking at, to get it down to its base components, to figure it out, to take it apart, to investigate it, and just find joy in the unknown. So when I think about science, that's really what I'm thinking about.
Kendra, what do you think?
I think when I think about what science is, and I'm thinking of the conversation we had in our last episode, and doubt came up a lot. In talking about like how that's not always welcome in religion. I think when we talk about science, though, doubt is a really crucial part of like testing a hypothesis. Like you want to apply your skepticism fully and without reservation to some empirical study that you're testing because it helps to sharpen an answer that can emerge from these questions that you're asking.
So I now know that this is just American propaganda, but growing up, I was so captivated with that image of Christopher Columbus sailing over the Atlantic Ocean, imagining that all of humanity thought that the world was flat, and if you went too far in one direction in the ocean, that you'd just fall off and die, but that he had the courage to stand up and say, no, the earth is round. And I'm going to get to India by going the other direction. And I'll be the first one over there to start the tea trade or whatever. That spirit behind that just says, I have an idea. I have a hypothesis. And I'm going to test it. And I'm going to explore. And I'm going to push the edges of what we think that we know. I'm going to dig deeper into the mystery, into what is potentially knowable or maybe even unknowable. That drive, that image that's behind that, that is what drives me. That is my love of science, is just that perpetual push into the unknown and into, in some cases, the unknowable. Of course, now I know that we've known that the Earth is round since Aristarchus, like 2,000 years ago, and Columbus was actually a horrible person. But the spirit behind it is still captivating.
So when I think of science, many of the things that all of you said resonate with me. I think about, you know, trying to figure out something, trying to answer a question. The natural curiosity that comes into play when trying to answer questions. The way I describe science to my students is that everyone is a scientist. Everyone is born a scientist. When you get into the education system, we drive it out in some situations, but it's this whole natural curiosity of wanting to be able to figure out something. When you think about, I have this great set of photos that I show of my children when they were 3 months old, and you know, all they could do at that time is just lay where, however it is you set them down, that's how they lay. They can't turn over or do anything yet. And so there's this great shot of my son laying on the floor and looking straight up with his mouth wide open. And I have a picture of him close up, and then I zoomed out. And before I show that second shot, I always ask everyone, what do you think he's looking at when he's in a living room floor looking up and his mouth is wide open? So what do you guys think?
Like, you ceiling can... fan?
Right.
Wait, did I get it right?
You did.
Yeah.
We had just turned on the ceiling fan. And I think it may have been the first time he had ever seen anything like that. And you could just see, I wish I had it in video. You could see the awe on his face and the curiosity. And I could just imagine what was going through that little brain was, is what is that? And how did that just happen?
And that how can I get it into my mouth?
Yeah, that too. But I use that to tell my students that's being a scientist, is asking a question and then trying to figure out a way to solve or answer that question in some way with our natural curiosity. Yes, it's more complex than that, but when you break it down to its basics, that's what science is.
I think also, as you're saying that, it's that curiosity factor, which allows us the freedom to be okay with being wrong. And that, for me, the concept of right and wrong actually doesn't fit with science so well. So when I was working as an analytical chemist, I was working in a biopharmaceutical company, and one of the chemists who was trying to make one of the products would come to me and say, "Hey, did I make it right? You know, did I do what I set out to do?" And more often than not, I would say, "No, you did not." And they were very unhappy. But what we came up with is that there is no such thing as bad data. That, okay, so it didn't work. So now I need to go about this problem in a different way. I didn't do it wrong. I just didn't do it in the way to achieve my desired outcome. And I think that's a different way of looking at the world than I have to do this right. It's like, in order to achieve my outcome, I went on a different path, and that's okay. But that gave me information. Now I know what happened. Now I can figure out how to do this a little bit differently to obtain the same outcome. But knowing all of that information, were I to choose a different outcome, I now have all of that extra information that maybe one day I can actually go down that path and see where it leads me. So for me, it's that curiosity which allows us to expand our understanding of right and wrong, of failure and success.
Well said.
I think that you raised an interesting point, Rachel, about this idea of right and wrong not fitting in a like scientific framework. And it makes me think of the ways that I hear people talk sometimes about science, usually in the context of having, you know, dialogue about science versus religion, and how, you know, there are people who say, if we could just get rid of religion and just live by the rules of science, like let science be the guiding framework for our lives, then we would be better for it. And I understand where that sentiment comes from, but I also think that like science is more neutral than we wish to believe it is. Like, we still have to choose what we do with the outcomes we find to the questions that we set out to ask. And that's not always easy to figure out how to do. And yeah, so I think that like scientific inquiry is really important and valuable, but like not everything that science teaches us about the workings of the universe and like what's natural in the world, like that wouldn't be a way that we would want to structure human life necessarily. Like there's some scary things that happen out in nature and scary things that we find through scientific inquiry. And so it doesn't make sense to automatically assume that something that we find through the tools of science is good.
I think you bring up another sort of overlapping point there, that as scientists, we're still human. I mean, I think I made that point last week, that as religious leaders, at the end of the day, still human. At the end of the day, a scientist, still human. So whatever foible or whatever bias we have it's going to come through in our work. And so even if nature itself is neutral, the scientist who is looking at that is not. And the understanding and manipulation of the data, which happens, just even thinking of the experiment itself, whatever it might be, is not neutral. And then how the interpretation of the data itself is applied is not neutral. And I think that's where humanity comes in, and where peer review is really helpful and crucial to sort of say, wow, your bias led you in a completely different way than anybody else would understand your data. Or it turns out you made that whole experiment up, right? Because you wanted to showcase something. And I think that's really important to understand.
I think a good example of what you're just saying about how even conducting an experiment is not a neutral process, and that we bring our own biases to those decisions. There is, if you look through a lot of like psychological studies, just like if you look at who a lot of the samples are for just your average experimental study with human subjects, there's this problem or like issue known that we have a weird problem in experimental studies. And when I say weird, I'm intentionally like using that word as an acronym. So WEIRD stands for white, educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic. And what we find is that a lot of studies tend to have people that come from those like demographic markers. And what that does is it kind of skews the results that we see in all of these studies that are looking at human behavior and like human outcomes, because we can't fully generalize all the literature we have on human subjects to like the global population when really like a lot of the people that are participating in those studies are coming from particular socioeconomic backgrounds and particular like racial groups. So I think that's a good example of what you raised, is that we have to like really look at the way that we're making decisions about how we do science. Otherwise, we might just think that we're being neutral without really being careful, I guess.
Well, yeah. I mean, like, so like the 19th century, when evolution first stormed onto the scene, scientists, both natural scientists and social scientists, are talking about survival of the fittest in terms of survival of the strongest. And of course we were, science was being done by Western European white men who were in the business of colonialism. And so we read the facts of evolution through the lens of colonialism, and we came up with this brutal image of the world where life develops to the point where it is now because the strongest male is able to take the female. Or it's always this idea of conquest. There was this language of conquest and destruction and war. But the more that we have studied evolution, and especially in our more interconnected times, the more we're seeing that evolution proceeds through collaboration more than domination. Yeah, there's sometimes here and there where a species is more dominant and so they win out. But for the most part, it's collaboration. I mean, look at us humans. We've got nothing going for us. We're naked and we've got no claws, and our teeth are terrible, and our eyesight is, you know, average at best. But we have dominated the planet because of our ability to collaborate better than almost any other animal. And it's the same facts. It's just now we are interpreting them differently because of the place where we're coming at it from. And I don't mean that in a negative way. I mean, that's fine. That's great. That's how all of us are. This is all facts are filtered through our particular worldview, our particular lenses. And it's just, we need to be honest about that. We need to acknowledge that, yeah, these are our worldviews, these are our biases, and these are going to color the way we interpret the data we receive. If you can do that, if you can come out with this sort of intellectual humility, then there's a whole wealth of truth to be found on the other side. But this can't be done if you're just in an echo chamber. If the peers that are reviewing the work that you're doing are people who are just like you, who think like you, who see the world like you and look like you, then your data, your interpretation of the data will never be questioned. Peer review is only good at helping us remove our bias when the peers that are reviewing it are diverse and different from us. So it is so important to be upfront and acknowledge your biases before you begin this process so that you can find other perspectives to help challenge what you think is the truth.
Where I think we get into trouble is that in the more nuanced a field, the more narrow the demographics.
Right.
And that's something that as a society, we still have to work on. I mean, we're working on that just straight up with the biggest demographic where men and women, or male and female rather, how many people are in the field and how many people are actually presenting, right? And that there's this one particular website about, oh gosh, I'm going to have to look it up and it'll be in our show notes. It has something to do with neurobiology, where they're presenting, where they take a look at every conference that exists and says, okay, this is just a straight up gender breakdown for the people that actually know what they're talking about. And they'll say something like 25%. And then they look at the total number of people in the conference, who structured them, and how many people presented, and that gender breakdown. And it's fascinating to see that, let's say it's a 25% breakdown in the field, you might still see 100% men. And so even there, we can say, okay, I'm recognizing that inside this field of peers, we still actually need to have as wide of a demographic scope as we can possibly achieve. And then maybe we can get to the point where we're actually breaking down those barriers and bringing in even more diverse voices inside this concept of peer.
So I think then, if I can add to that real quick, Rachel, I like what you were saying. And that kind of gets to another thing that we kind of want to talk about today, about who is doing science. You know, I think when we break down what is science, and now we're going into who is it, who are scientists, who does science, you pointed out a problem which still exists, that predominantly science is done by white men. And as that percentage is dropping, the perception by society still is that it's done mostly by white males. The perception is not as high as it used to be, or the percentage of people who believe that is not high as it used to be, but it's still pretty high. And there's a long line of research that's looked into this, the Draw Scientist Test research. And so I'm curious, when we think about all this, about who can do science, where they do it, what it is, how does this come into play with what it is we're about, which is talking about science and religion? Where does all this come into play?
Well, I think this question connects to the conversation we've been having about peer review. And so what's coming to my mind is there's a philosopher of science. Her name's Helen Longino. I'm not sure if people pronounce it Helen Longino or Helen Longino, but I'm going to say Longino. And she talks about the peer review process, and she writes a lot about how scientific, like what we like to think of as scientific objectivity, is inherently social, for better or for worse. So I think that, like, this question of who can do science, I think that it, or at least by the way that Helen Longino talks about it, like, anybody can do science. It doesn't necessarily mean that they are, like, going to be good at it by the standards that we set for science. But, like, so she gives this example of the peer review process and says that if you have people who are reviewing a scientific study, a paper for publish, they might not know everything that's in that paper, but they are still, they've been deemed worthy by society somehow to like have this position of power to determine what gets to count as scientific knowledge. So there's this social activity of like creating what we deem scientific knowledge, even if we find out years later that it's off base somehow or incorrect. And so I think like ideally, it's nice to think that there is this correct way of doing science and this really ideal correct way of being a scientist. But I think on the ground, Longino has this really important point about how that it's just we work with the tools that we have and we might not know that they're imperfect until, you know, like 50 years later. But it is a social process of determining what gets to count as knowledge, what people are going to read in the science magazine, because the public has to put their trust in people that we deem authorities in their scientific fields. So it just it makes sense that it's this social process, whether or not we really want it to work that way. She would say that is how it works.
Well, it's getting back to the idea that science is a human endeavor. You know, as Rachel said earlier, science is done by humans. So, and I think that's where we get to this discussion about science and religion again, is that to me, when you talk about specific issues of evolution, geologic time, climate change, I truly believe that what it boils down to is that it's that the people who adamantly oppose those particular areas of science or other areas of science, it's more that they just don't understand what science is. They just seem to have a general misunderstanding of how science is done, of the purpose of science. And there's a general mistrust of the knowledge that's generated, a distrust of the community.
Well, but some of that distrust is founded.
Agreed.
So I see science as just this wide open exploration of just new truths and goodness. And it's all wide-eyed and optimism for me because science has been done generally by people who look like me and so respect the bodies of people that look like me. And so it's been all fun and games, but there's a lot of communities out there that have been systematically disenfranchised or abused or taken advantage of or lied to in the name of scientific progress. I mean, it goes way beyond, like the Tuskegee syphilis experiment is probably the most well-known, where a group of people infected with syphilis were told that they would be receiving treatment, but in reality, the scientists were just studying what it looks like for black men to die of syphilis and how horrible that is. There are recorded cases of people using living slaves in order to test new medical procedures. There's how many native communities have been displaced and disenfranchised in the name of technological and scientific progress. So it's all hunky-dory for someone like me to look idealistically at science, but I have to acknowledge at the same time that for many people, science has not just been neutral. It's been devastating.
I agree. There is definitely some of this distrust is warranted. One of the things I try to help people understand when having these conversations is I like to pull back a little bit and ask, is that necessarily a distrust in the science itself? Or is it a distrust in the scientists? So the people...
I don't think it matters.
Is it the fault of science or is it the fault of the people doing the science?
I don't think
so. So there are a lot of people who won't step foot in my church or any church for that matter because of what was done to them when they were younger or even recently by people in the church, the abuses that they've had in the church. And whether that was done as an abuse of Christianity or whether Christianity is to blame or whether the church is to blame for enabling that kind of behavior. At the end of the day, the net result of it all is that there is a person who will not be a part of this church. And so honestly, to me, playing the blame game and trying to figure out who's at fault doesn't matter.
So then how do you reach those people?
I think that's a different episode.
Okay.
So for me, that means like getting out of the church, being a different kind of pastor that doesn't trigger the same responses, changing the vernacular, abandoning certain phrases and ideas that have outlived their usefulness, whose, you know, the baggage is just too much to salvage anything from. But honestly, I'm not sure that that applies to work in science.
I was actually just going to add, and therefore disagree with you, Zach. I think the same thing does apply to science in the sense that, from my perspective, some scientists and even the concept of science has been put on a pedestal. And who gets to do it? If that person doesn't look like me or speak like me, then I can't do that. And so it's our jobs to communicate in ways that say, nope, this is science. Science is not some white guy in a lab coat in a fancy lab somewhere. Science is a way of understanding the world, which it doesn't matter what your age or what your education level, science is a way of understanding. And it's our job then to communicate that in ways that are not harmful and to recognize that there have been human beings who have, under just like under the guise of religion, have done things under the guise of science as completely reprehensible. I mean, even the concept of race and racism came from scientific knowledge of the 19th century, which is, from our understanding, total bull. It is completely harmful and nothing else. And I mean, speaking now as a Jew, we're not we're still human beings. We're not that different. There's no anatomical difference between us. There's not horns. Right, as some Renaissance painter misunderstood the Bible and decided to do that. And that has then perpetuated over the last several hundred years to the point where some people still believe that. Kid you not, 2019, it's still a belief that is held.
That you have a horn?
Well, doesn't that Jews come have from horns? Jerome wow. in like the 4th century mistranslating a Hebrew word? I forget which one. When Moses came down from the mountain, his face
That's
was shining,
it.
And the word for shining, the word for horn, are like one letter off
That's
from
it.
Each other, and so
and then drew a picture, and then drew a picture about that mistranslation with horns, and then suddenly Jews have horns, and it's like, wait a minute, that doesn't even make sense. Or you can even just look at the caricatures of Jews always having a particular look. That's how you kind of know something is anti-Semitic, based on those pictures. So I think it is the same, that when we harm a person with science, it's the same as harming a person with religion, and that it all boils down to the person, but the perception then is the mistrust in an institution or in a way of life. So a person who, for example, who might have been harmed by religion now says, well, I'm never going to trust that again, and I'm all science all the time, and you know, I'm never setting foot in a place of faith. And the opposite can be true too.
You have people who will advocate and I'm not saying people who are atheists, people who are anti-theists, who will advocate that religion, because, and it may be because of a personal experience they've had, or just, you know, the challenging history associated with religion, but they will say that religion is the root of all evil. And then you will have individuals who will say that science is the root of all evil. And all of these evil things we have now are because of science, and or because of evolution, or, you know, they'll get very specific and talk about a particular area of science. And so when you have a messenger sending that message and you have other people listening, they start to believe that. And so I think part of the issue is helping them understand and realize that that's not the purpose of science. That's not the purpose of religion. Religion didn't make evil. Science didn't make evil. It's the people doing the work who misused and abused either science or religion that led to these bad experiences. And I know I'm diminishing the bad experiences, but it's the easier way to say it. Thank you.
So I have to confess that even though I, you know, I did this Sinai and Synapses Fellowship and I've written a ton about science and I've done a lot of educating in religious contexts on helping religious people to embrace science, that at the end of the day, I still feel unqualified to do science. Well, at the same time, I will tell people that, oh, anyone's a scientist. Everyone is. Look, even just the earlier today, I had some observation and I made a hypothesis and I tested it and I did science then and there. And I tell the kids that they're all scientists. But and I think I believe that. But somewhere deep down inside, I still feel really unqualified to do this work. Like I'm just pretending to be a scientist, you know, and I'm acutely aware of the fact that I'm the only person on this podcast without a formal science education. And so in some ways, I still feel kind of like I'm just pretending to be a scientist on the internet. So I feel like I have to at least acknowledge that for all the people out there who, like me, love science kind of as a hobby and don't feel qualified to engage in these fields, that you're not alone.
So it sounds like that you're afraid that you're a fraud. And if you feel that way and yet you're saying these things, then perhaps somebody else who's saying these things is also a fraud, which I think is a valid fear and concern.
I agree.
I would add to that, I have a lovely congregant who writes poetry and has published some books in poetry. And this person gave a talk at our synagogue and said, in the name of their teacher, who is a poet? A person who writes poetry. So who is a scientist? A person who does science. And I think our challenge is to say that you're right, Zach. You are not educated in the ways of science. That does not mean that you cannot be a scientist. It just means that you're not going to be published as such. Your name is not going to be in the Nature magazine. But that doesn't mean that you're not doing science and that you can't have that perspective and that awe and that curiosity and that love of doubt. And I think that's where we have to change our dialogue and to say, yeah, you want to put Mentos inside of Diet Coke and watch it explode? And then you can say, well, why Diet Coke? What is it about aspartame that is necessary that doesn't happen in Coke Zero, that doesn't happen in regular Coke, in cane sugar Coke? And that can be your understanding. Or try it in Sprite and it just doesn't work the same, right? And that is science. And to diminish that, I think, diminishes our experiences and continues to perpetuate the stereotype that science is on some sort of unreachable pedestal.
Well, so how much is... Oh, sorry, Kendra.
We're also very excited about this.
Yeah. Go ahead. Zach, go ahead.
Well, I just had a question. I was just wondering how much of this apparent disconnect between just your average person and science has to do with this increasing level of specialization of science, where now it seems like if you want to know anything about science, you have to spend 10 years studying one laser-focused subgenre of this science. It's no longer just you're a biologist. Now you are a microbiological ethicist, or I don't know what it is. But it just seems so much less accessible.
I think at some point, there's a difference between, looking at nuances and looking at the big scope. So you can paint paint using a broad stroke, but yeah, it's intimidating. But the same thing is true if you look at English, right? You no longer major in English. You major in 18th century American literature. But to say, I don't do English doesn't make any sense, right? To say I don't do science because I didn't major in molecular biology, specializing in the genome, that doesn't make sense. I was trained as an analytical chemist. Okay. But that doesn't mean I have nothing to say on physics or calculus or geology. It just says that those then become more relegated to opinions and an intelligent conversation as opposed to jargon and extreme educated understanding. Does that make sense?
So when Zach responded by saying, like, what about the specializations in science? I think that this is also connected to the question that Ian originally asked us about, like, who does science? We have on the one hand, like Rachel says, like, if you're a scientist, if you are someone who does science. But I think that there is something really important about the shifting, like, definition of what science means, because the specialization of science is a real barrier to someone who wants to do a particular kind of science. And I think it's true that, like, anyone can do some kinds of science, especially, like, if you have the tools to be educated in those specializations. But I think the difference is significant between like the medieval ages, where people were doing a kind of science that we wouldn't even call it science as in modern science, but we would have called it natural philosophy, where you're taking observations of the world around you. And then, like, over time, we start to rely more on mathematical models that are more abstract and more distanced from the everyday person. And then you get to, like, the 19th and 20th century, and you have all these specializations where the scientists are disconnected, not intentionally so, but there is this disconnect between your average person and someone who has, like, done enough training to be a scientist. And that, I think, does create a lot of problems in the way that we talk about science or try to communicate with the public about scientific findings, because sometimes it's really hard, I think, to communicate something that is, like, a scientific experiment that has, like, major implications for the world in terms of politics or whatever, if those findings are coming out of a discipline that require so much background knowledge in math or physics or whatever. So I think that there is, like, I like the sentiment that, like, people, they can do science, and I believe that's true, but I also do see that there is this serious disconnect between those worlds.
And I think, though, and I agree with you, Kendra, about the disconnect, but I think that's one of the reasons why within my courses and talks and conversations, I try to get back to the general idea of what science is, to pull away from the discussion of specializations, acknowledging the specializations are there, they're necessary, we need them, it's advanced society, I'm fine with all of that. But when you break it down to what any person who has the education and background and are considered scientists is, that they're trying to answer questions. They have questions, they've made observations, they have curiosity. So all of these things, I would argue that they all have in common in some way, no matter the specialization. They're trying to answer a question. They're focusing on natural phenomena. They're using evidence to answer these questions, right? They have to go through the peer review. So all of before it's accepted knowledge. And so I know it's simplifying it. But again, it just boils. And I think that's where we could try to get rid of this disconnect, is that people, as Rachel, you said earlier, science is perceived as on, like, this pedestal that can't be touched unless you're a particular type of person. But when we pull back and really dig in on what science is and who people are doing it, they're curious individuals. When you go back to their core, there's still people asking questions. They just have gone through the training and experience to be able to answer certain questions that we can't answer because we don't have that experience or training.
You know, Kendra, you and I are on the same wavelength. Yeah.
I have a question for you, Ian, because you have these conversations with people all the time, like, more than the rest of us, about, you know, like, what does it mean to do science? Like, you're teaching people how to teach science. Right. So I want to ask a question that is maybe, like, playing a little bit of devil's advocate.
That's fine.
So whenever you talk about the core elements of science being or the core elements of being a scientist are people who have curiosity and they're using evidence to answer questions about, you know, like what's happening in the world. What would you say to someone who sees themselves as curious, and maybe they like in fact are a curious person, but what counts as evidence for them is not what you would count as evidence? So they would maybe say, yeah, like there's evidence all around us about, you know, the like handprint of God has created this and has created this. And so that leads me to the conclusion that this is, you know, the way the world works, or like the world was created in 7 days because like we have all this evidence for the way that God has intervened in the world, which would be evidence for them versus someone else who would look at the evidence, whatever that means, in the world and say, yes, clearly like we have a Big Bang situation here. So I'm just curious, like, how do you distinguish for people what evidence really means when we're talking about science?
So one of the things I really focus on in conversations is the notion of natural phenomena and getting into what is considered natural phenomena. I don't like the idea of scientists trying to prove or disprove an existence of any deity. So for us, you know, I'm trying to prove or disprove God because it's not dealing with natural phenomena. So if someone started talking to me about, well, you know, I see evidence for the hand of God, I would ask them what that evidence is. You know, where are you finding this evidence to help me better understand where you're coming from? And then would start kind of digging in, is that natural phenomena that's occurring, or is it something, you know, more supernatural? And it's not diminishing their experiences. It's not saying that they're wrong. It's just something that I would try to dig in on as a way to try to see, are we looking at a scientifically viable explanation or not? Rachel shaking her head.
I am. and I want to jump in.
Go ahead.
So solar eclipses happen frequently. They don't happen so frequently over land, given how much water is on our Earth. But there was a solar eclipse recently, and this one happened to be over Chile and Argentina. That is a natural phenomenon. Moon, sun, Earth align in a really awesome way, such that the sky goes dark in the middle of the day. So we are witnessing a natural phenomenon. That's my evidence. But that is also my evidence. Again, I'm sort of playing off of Kendra's devil's advocate piece. Yeah, I can tell you that's what I'm coming to you as. That is my proof of the hand of God. That God brings darkness during the day. And so here we have something which we're both looking at. Sky, right? What we see, the observation, is a natural phenomenon that can then be interpreted in lots of different ways. And I think that's the challenge, right? I mean, I'm not even talking using scripture as scientific proof to say, oh, you know, the 10 plagues of Egypt. Well, how, you know, how does the Nile turn red with blood? Well, it can turn red because of this special algae that blooms at a particular time. Great. I'm not even talking something like that. We watched the eclipse, or for this particular cohort of the Sinai and synapses, you know, we got the call on the day of the eclipse, August 21st, 2017.
That was so cool, by the way. Perfect timing.
Shout out to Jeff Middleman.
Mm-hmm.
We can see it, but it's our understanding and our background that gives us the next step. And I think that's the disconnect. And tell me if I'm wrong there, Kendra.
No, I think that this is the reason that I asked that question, because I think the back and forth that you just had illustrates the point that I was hoping that we would make, which is that, yeah, we do have these ways of observing the world, but there comes an edge where people have to infer the ultimate foundation of what they think is the cause of those natural phenomena. And it's really hard, I think, when you are trying to, or at least I imagine for you, Ian, that would be a real challenge to try to like separate those two things, because, you know, there are a lot of scientists who have figured out ways to compartmentalize their scientific training from their theological background or beliefs. And I think that is also something that became really important for modern science versus natural philosophy that preceded it, was that we now have this compartmentalization of like theology from what we now call scientific inquiry. But I still see that it's very challenging to teach some people how to compartmentalize those things, because we value keeping them compartmentalized. I just think it's interesting.
Zach, you were going to say something.
I was just going to say that Buddy, the tiny T-Rex from Dinosaur Train.
I love Dinosaur Train.
Well, he says that a hypothesis is just an idea you can test.
He doesn't say it. He sings it.
Well, I mean, he sings it and he says it. And sometimes corrected. Tiny, Shiny, and Don say it too. It's kind of a big theme throughout
I'm
this thing.
I'm sensing this is something that only parents would understand.
But
parents,
you should totally children. Watch it. You need
it's
to
great
watch
for
it.
Adults too. I've learned so much more about Troodons than I ever thought I would.
And I've actually communicated with the science advisor.
Stop it.
The paleontologist who comes on periodically on that show. Yep.
Can we get him on the podcast?
Dr. Scott, the paleontologist.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. My son would love to talk to him. And by my son, I mean me.
He's pretty neat. Sorry.
No. Anyway, I think Buddy, he's onto something. I think he's got it nailed down that, you know, we get the same data and we come to different conclusions, and then we can use the scientific method to examine the assumptions that led us from point A to point B. And using those various tools of science, we are able to examine our own prejudices and preconceived notions. And then from there, we can continue to use those tools to hopefully get closer and closer and closer to the actual truth. The scientific method never promises to give us the truth. If anything, the opposite is true. In order for something to be useful in science, it has to be falsifiable. It has to be able to be proved wrong in order for it to be useful, regardless of if it's true or not, if it's useful. And I just love that about science. I remember hearing recently somebody said to me, did you hear that towards the end of his life, Stephen Hawking disproved his own black hole theory he came up with when he was younger? And that they said it like I was supposed to be ashamed of that, like he was supposed to have been proved to be some kind of quack. But no, that's the whole point. How wonderful is it that there's this system in place where you are encouraged to second guess your preconceived notions and the things that you used to believe, that there is an apparatus in place to doubt productively and to push further and further and further into the mystery. And that's the beauty of it all. So going back to the eclipse, you and I both see the same observation about the eclipse, and you say that it is the hand of God. Obviously, what else could it be? And I have some astronomical explanation for it about how the moon is 400 times smaller than the sun, and the sun is 400 times farther away. And so when they line up, they cancel each other out. And science gives us the tools to figure out which one of those is closer to the truth.
I think that's a good point, that there is a big difference between empirical observation or evidence and explanation.
Correct. And I think, you know, when we go back to the eclipse, or, you know, another classic example I always think about is the rainbow. There are many instances of references to the rainbow within the Bible and with other, you know, Norse mythology, Native American history. We have a scientific understanding of the rainbow. And so, you know, Isaac Newton coming up with the scientific understanding of the rainbow, to me, does not diminish the potential theological power for someone when they see a rainbow, when they see an eclipse. So I'll have to share a picture in the notes of, you know, the eclipse that we had in our area, Rachel, a few years ago, as you were referring to. I've got a few pictures I took with my eyes closed so I wouldn't burn out my retina. but it was cloudy, so we didn't get to see the whole thing. But I have these amazing images that I took with my phone that were just awe-inspiring. Each time I look at them, I'm so moved just by that, those few pictures and the memories it bring back. But I know why it happened scientifically. I know why this phenomena is happening. But to me, it does not diminish the potential power and awe I see in how, if I choose to relate that to God, it's not diminished for me because I know the science behind it.
Well, Newton kind of did the same thing with the rainbow too, right? That there's not actually seven colors in a rainbow. Roy G. Biv is a lie, or maybe an oversimplification.
Correct.
At least. There's no reason to subdivide the spectrum into seven primary colors. That's totally arbitrary. In fact, at one point it was five. He chose those seven colors because there are seven notes in a major scale, and seven is the number of God in the Bible, and it had all this spiritual overtones to it that he found compelling, and so he went with it.
Right.
I think that as we're, you know, towing that line too, I would actually go a little bit further, Ian, and say, because I know of the science behind it, I have even more appreciation for what it is. Not that it doesn't diminish it, but it enhances, actually, my love of this and my sense of awe. I know we keep using that word, only grows when I see natural phenomena, right? When fractals are seen in nature, right? When the perfect spiral is understood from a mathematical perspective, right? I mean, that is just truly phenomenal. And it doesn't matter that I know or don't know the science. To me, that adds to my joy that I have the ability to understand the world in that way. How incredible is it that I have that ability, that I can see a rainbow and say, wow, I understand the separation of wavelengths of colors and still find it truly astonishing every right. single time.
And I that's why with our work, you know, I hope to be able to reach those who do struggle with this idea of having both science and religion in their lives, because I do believe, and I think you guys probably would agree with this, that having both in your life does bring a new level of appreciation, just the way you described it, Rachel, a new awe. Like, I get more moved by it that, oh, and now I have this understanding behind this natural phenomena, and now let's interpret it and see even more powerful how this could be for me in this particular moment.
And that, yes, I feel to like, interpret it.
Correct.
But not let it change the science itself. I mean, to go back to Newton, he couldn't figure out why the planets didn't collide into each other over time. And it wasn't, so he just decided that, well, it must just be God stopping in from time to time to fine tune the universe. And he just stopped thinking. So I think we have to be really aware, really cognizant, really careful to allow our scientific understanding to inform our spirituality, but not our spirituality to diminish our science.
Or vice versa.
Or vice versa. This has been episode 2 of the Down the Wormhole podcast. If you like what you hear, tell your friends. New podcasts spread best through word of mouth. If you'd like to continue on this journey with us, make sure you hit subscribe, leave a review, and visit us at downthewormhole.com for show notes and more. If you want to join the conversation, find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email if you have any questions or ideas for future episodes. Next week, we're creating imaginary museums for ourselves. But now, does anyone want to send us out with an inspirational quote?
The quote that I was thinking of, I don't know who said it, and I don't know how it goes.
Just attribute it to Einstein. That's what everyone
You know,
does.
That's pretty much what everyone does.
Yeah.
Did Buddy the Dinosaur say anything inspiring? Is that his name? Buddy?
Yeah, Buddy.
Buddy the T-Rex.
You really need to watch Dinosaur Train. Okay.
Yeah, I'll get to it eventually.